This is the Elevate Podcast, where we have conversations to elevate your health, relationships, and soul. I'm Amanda Noga. I'm a yoga and Ayurveda practitioner, and each week I'm joined by my co-host, holistic health coach, Sarah Hopkins. So let's dive into this week's episode. Hello, everyone. It's Amanda here. Welcome back to the Elevate Podcast. As per usual, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Sarah Hopkins. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Everything is pretty good here in WA.
After a few weeks of craziness, the dust has settled.
Well, I'm now officially the second class citizen, one of the second class citizens in Perth. I'm not allowed into many, many establishments, but I'm okay with that.
I think it's day one, right? So I guess you don't have that much of a gauge, but I wonder if it's going to be actually enforced by the establishments.
I think the general consensus is, or the general observation from other places seems to be, that initially there's a high level of compliance and that drops off very significantly as time passes.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
So
it's pretty relaxed place.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a bit like the checking in. Like, you know, at the beginning everyone was checking in and now most people don't check in. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's, intentional rebellion. I think that that's just literally people are sort of over it, you know.
The novelty is worn off.
Yes, exactly. But in other news, Raphael started his first day of year one yesterday. Oh. So that's very sweet. Yes.
Wow.
He's a
Were
big
you emotional?
Now. Not really, because he had already done a full year of pre-primary, which is still like 5 days a week of school. So it wasn't a huge difference, if that makes sense.
It's a smooth transition.
Yeah, it was a smooth transition. Same school, you know, he knows all the teachers. He knows a lot of the students. There was nothing unfamiliar, really, about the
whole
experience.
And does he get a new teacher this year?
Every year they get a new teacher. The only thing that's annoying, although, you know, it is something that they have encountered last year, is that the teachers are wearing masks.
Oh.
I know. And his teacher, I think, does wear the mask fairly fastidiously. So that's a shame. But no, all good.
Wow. I wonder how they make sense of that. Their little six-year-old
brains. Yeah. Well, maybe the teachers take them off, because I hope so, because it is really hard to connect with another human whose face is, you know, 70% covered.
Definitely, especially while you're still learning language and, you know, body language cues and all the other ways that we communicate. Facial expressions are such a big part of how we understand one another.
Definitely.
Oh dear.
And how is life in Bali? What has been happening?
Life in Bali is good. My husband just did a dark retreat. I don't know if people have heard of this type of idea, but it's basically you go into a dark room voluntarily he did 5 days, and so
what,
that
just
also
on
meant
his own? On his
yeah,
own?
On his own, so you have like no light, no sound, no stimulation, no Wi-Fi, obviously, like no nothing, no writing, no books, no podcasts, nothing. You just
with
yourself.
Wow.
So that was actually cool for me at home on the other side, because it also gave me a bit of time to reflect and, just the space, you know, to have some insights and realizations of my own. So that was really cool. I've just, I guess, like
to share what had been coming up is that I'm really just realizing how I have a sense of rushing constantly inside. And I know you probably think, and a lot of people probably think, I'm very chill. And I guess I am to a degree, but since having a baby, and I think it is to do with the state of my nervous system still at almost 2 years old, which is now really my intention to break that pattern and to get my nervous system out of this loop. But I've really observed how my ability to concentrate, my concentration span is just shot. I have no attention span. I'm like a goldfish. And yeah, I'm just really realizing that the quality of my mind is just constantly rushing and thinking this thing, ping-ponging all over the place. And so that has and is affecting every aspect of my life, from the effectiveness of my work to our relationship, you know, our Mark and I's ability to really connect and for me to really be present with him. Of course, my relationship to Sage. And I guess the interesting part of this realization was that I believe that whatever age your child is, it's a opportunity to kind of heal and transmute whatever was going on for you at that age, whatever was imposed or imprinted at that time. And when I really went into like what is the cellular memory of this rushing, it was, yeah, really far back, like in toddlerhood, in childhood, of basically my mum being too busy for me. And I can understand on a practical level, she had a newborn at that time, as well as me. So she would have been really busy. And I get that, totally get it. But what it has kind of perpetuated in me is this sense that I need to hurry. I need to, you know, quickly say what I need to say or do what I need to do in order to be like seen, heard, understood. And so, yeah, I'm really working to break that pattern within myself as it's continuing now in like my mid-30s, and being really aware that as I reparent myself, I am not imposing that same pattern onto Sage. So just really being as present as I can with him and not rushing him and not letting him feel that I have time for him. I'm not too busy for him, you know, let him finish whatever he wants to do or say. And I can, you know, he's not even two, but I can already see how easy it is to go into this thing of like, come on, let's get your shoes on. Come on, let's finish your dinner. Blah, 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 blah. And just to be in that like rush, rush, next thing, next thing, next thing. Let's have a bath. Come on, let's go. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. It's like, whoa, I have just caught myself, you know, in that loop. So I'm really trying to be present with him in that way, not rushing him, and in turn, like, not rushing myself and just telling myself, like, hey, I'm not rushing you. It's okay. You've got time. You can take time. Take the space that you need. Like, I'm really talking to myself like a child, and it might sound really basic. And as someone that's practiced yoga and meditation for a long time, I thought I had this down pat. But after having a baby, it's almost like, it's like restore to factory settings. Okay. She's like back to the original conditioning and this like perpetual rushing and, you know, inner busyness. So I'm back at square one and I'm just working through that. So that's been really cool to realize that and kind of catch myself in that.
That's very cool.
So yeah, that's what's gone down over here. But today we wanted to get on the podcast and talk about psychedelics, which I think is a very fun topic to talk about. And I guess if we want to like give a loose definition of what we're talking about when it comes to psychedelics, it's this I guess, a grouping or a class of drugs or substances that have a primary effect on our psychology and affect our mind and our state of consciousness. It creates an altered state of consciousness. And so these can be natural things, they can be chemical-based man-made things. And the way that I kind of perceive psychedelics as a whole is kind of on a spectrum from kind of gentle, more fun experiences to experiences and substances that can be really quite deep and quite like earth-shattering to our mental paradigm. So I'm talking like on one end of the spectrum, we've got things like MDMA and maybe cannabis, depending on like your constitution.
Coffee, maybe, I think, is a psychedelic. I think even coffee, I think so.
Wow.
That's
got to be the most commonly used psychedelic in the world.
Well, I think Michael Pollan sort of talks about coffee as being like it does give you a slightly altered state.
It does alter our consciousness.
Yeah.
But I think so I'll just continue with my kind of spectrum. I guess more in the middle we've got things like maybe like mushrooms or cactus, LSD, and then like getting to the other end of the spectrum, there's DMT, there's ayahuasca, there's the frog medicines like Cambo, and what's the other one, Bufo. So there's a lot. That's not an exhaustive list, but the way that I kind of think about it is, you know, since like if we're talking about coffee being a psychedelic, it doesn't really land for me. I get the idea and I can understand why it's in that classification. But I think since psychedelics were used in mainly like research and laboratories and in the medical system back in like the 50s and 60s, since they kind of leaked out of that framework and those institutions and into maybe like alternative counterculture, hippie culture, psychedelics as a whole, I think, have mainly been aligned with like teachings of the East. And like I said, these alternative ways of being in our culture. So that's why coffee doesn't really land for me, because
I agree. I agree. I don't think in the sense that we're going to talk about them today, it makes sense. And it alters your state slightly, but it isn't used therapeutically, really.
Right. And I don't know many people that are having like, well, they shouldn't be having like hallucinogenic or like auditory channeling from coffee, although that could be interesting. Imagine if there was like a shop on every corner just selling cups of ayahuasca.
The world would be a better place, probably.
Well, it feels like to me, which is, I guess, why we've come to talk about psychedelics on the podcast, it feels like psychedelics are having somewhat of a renaissance in our era. It feels like they are being returned from like the underworld and the alternative cultures, and in many cases, especially with the natural psychedelics like ayahuasca and like mushrooms and even weed and cactus medicine, mescaline, these were all used across many cultures traditionally or through, you know, history and time. So at the moment, I can see that we're almost coming full circle from where we were at in the 50s and 60s. It's gone through this whole period of being used in counterculture and illegally and, you know, on the fringes of society, but now it's coming back into the labs and back into therapeutic use with the medical system, and people are doing deep scientific research on these substances that are helping people in really significant ways with mental health, with PTSD, with relationship issues, like all the full gamut of ways that these medicines can be used as real medicine. So Before we go any further, I think it would be cool to hear, Sarah, if you have any experiences that you want to share about psychedelics or, yeah, anything that comes to mind.
Yeah.
As we're bringing up this little definition.
Yes. So when we started talking about this as a topic, my initial thought was I don't have that much experience with psychedelics per se. It's only been recently, after doing a lot of listening and reading, that I've started to think about or started to be interested in exploring psychedelics. But upon reflection, actually, I have used psychedelics a lot, more recreationally rather than spiritually. Probably the predominant one that I have used is MDMA as a party drug. And I use that, you know, in my 20s a lot. So, you know, every weekend or, you know, many, very regularly. And you know, upon reflection, and we've, you know, spoken about this a lot in our friendship circle, our, you know, friendship circle, we all sort of bonded over that time and all used these, you know, MDMA recreationally together. And it did, it bonded us. There was, you know, obviously MDMA was developed either the 70s or the 80s, I can't remember, and it was used therapeutically for couples counseling. That was like its primary purpose. And then it, I think it was in the 80s, and then it escaped the therapeutic realms and fell out into the streets and became a class A drug. But its application therapeutically was connection and vulnerability, that the barriers come down, you feel love, you feel affinity, you feel oneness with others, you feel compassion, you feel, yeah, just, I mean, in simple terms, you really do. Like a lot of those sort of insecurities and barriers socially and in relationship, they really are broken down by MDMA. And so we, you know, we at that time in a certain group of friends that I still have, we forged these really deep and meaningful relationships facilitated by this psychedelic that we were taking, right? So, you know, we look back at those times and we're like, wow, you know, later on in life we've forged relationships and maybe not had that same capacity to go that deep and to build that trust and to build that rapport, certainly not as quickly as we did because we were using that. So that was my first sort of long-term experience or sort of that was my largest experimental phase of using a psychedelic. And then, like I said, in more recent years, I have read a lot of stuff and listened to a lot of people talking about this reemergence of psychedelics and their utilization in so many healing modalities, dealing with PTSD, dealing with alcohol addiction, dealing with lots of trauma, just being broadly really helpful. And so I have experimented with psilocybin probably, you know, a handful of times in the last couple of years. And I'll be honest, I've really only been pretty moderate to pretty conservative in terms of my application or capacity to really go deeply, if that makes sense. So dosing wise, I've been borderline micro, and I don't know why that is. I mean, there's a little bit of fear there, but I have actually found that experience for me and my body type, and we can expand on this later, hasn't been as rewarding as I expected it to be. And there's actually been some physiological downsides of that that have outweighed any of the purported benefits that I have seen. But having said that, I did like more microdose it. So I didn't go on some sort of intentional journey with it, but it altered my physiology in a way that I didn't like. And actually, you know, in retrospect.
Can you be specific?
Yeah, if you want me to go into that now, I think it triggered insomnia in me. So after I started tinkering with the mushrooms, I started to not be able to sleep. And then what I discovered was that because it works on serotonin, it can actually deplete serotonin. So obviously, I mean, I could be wrong, but it just completely coincided with that. And since then, I've noticed that if I ever do have a little micro dose, that my sleep is disrupted. Sometimes not on the night or day that I take it, but on subsequent nights, for numerous nights, I'll notice that my sleep is interrupted, because it does have physiological effects, and some are good and some are bad, right? And it's the same with MDMA, and you know, that was a long time ago, but that also depletes serotonin. So there's, you know, there are pros and cons, but yes, that's sort of been my experience with the psychedelics. And to be honest, after that experience, being older and not being in that sort of party orientated phase of my life, I'm sort of slightly reluctant. I would consider maybe doing an ayahuasca or something in a controlled environment, but my reluctance is a little bit higher than it was a year or so ago, just because there are knock-on effects. So that's sort of been my lived experience. What about you, Mads? You've got so many different experiences to share.
So many. But before we go on, I was wanting to ask you, do you think that having those MDMA experiences with your friends that are still your friends has been one of the reasons why you've had such long-lasting friendships? Like, do you,
yes,
on maybe even a subconscious level, like, still have that recognition of the unconditional love for one another that's there, even though, you know, life has moved on and you're in a different phase now? Do you think that has kind of supported your friendship long term?
Well, I think all that it's done is that because of that intensification of love, connection, vulnerability, trust, openness, all of those things that it facilitates, it meant that we probably did 6 years of really solid, consistent friendship in a year, if that makes sense.
Mm.
I think what it did was it solidified and cemented that relationship and deepened it, so that I think that's what it did. I wouldn't say that everything in those relationships is, you know, functional all the time and perfect and rosy. And I don't even know if there's an underlying sort of, you know, just like soul connection there from that. I just think that we were like able to transcend a very superficial relationship and grab a 10-year relationship in a really short period of time, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think, in a sense, that's what a lot of the psychedelics do to our mind, is they create almost like this extra neural plasticity where you can get on the fast track to deepening your friendship. Or, you know, if there is like a deeply held pattern like alcoholism, or, you know, like some sort of chronic pain or trauma that, you know, might be really hard to work through with other, like, talk therapy or even body-based therapy, to use these psychedelics really wisely is, I think, I mean, I'm like treading carefully here, but I do think that it gets us on the fast track, and it almost makes it a lot easier to break those patterns and to rewire our brains.
Yes,
so
definitely.
It makes a lot of sense what you're saying.
And just on that, just anecdotally, a story I think that's relevant to what you're saying is the, you know, the girl, is it Yongmi? I can't remember her name. the girl that escaped from North Korea, and she shares mm-hmm. and talks, and she was on the Joe Rogan podcast, and she's been on lots of other podcasts. Is it Yeonmi Park or something like that? Anyway, she is on the Joe Rogan podcast. We can link in the podcast. And like I said, she's very well known, and she talks very openly about North Korea. She shared a story. Obviously, she experienced a lot of trauma, like ridiculously high amounts of trauma. She said she saw people being killed and dead bodies every single day of her life in North Korea. And she was mm-hmm. literally like survival was her total state. So she had a lot of trauma, and she was struggling to conceive. And she did some MDMA therapy, like guided in therapeutic context. And she had all this trauma sort of trapped in her body, and obviously fear manifesting around, you know, probably even having that capacity to even allow a baby to come in because of that trauma. And so when she did her MDMA healing trauma, she conceived straight afterwards because she'd sort of healed some of those wounds. So, yeah, that's exactly what its potential for healing can offer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not that I was aware of that when I was taking it to go to nightclubs and sit on other people's couches and have deep and meaningful relationships. I mean conversations.
No, but yeah. Opening, like you said, like opening to that level of vulnerability and trust in relationships that were, I guess, functioning 90% of the time on the surface is really cool. It was really amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting that we don't have a framework for going to those depths in relationship with, you know, with friends or with our family or with our partners without substances,
which
is definitely a lot to do with all of our issues. It's not our natural state.
Yes.
And I think it's due to this perceived separation, which I think is what a lot of the psychedelics do, they melt away any illusions that we are separate from one another, separate from our souls, separate from, you know, God or the universe, whatever language you like to use. That is their, I guess, the beauty in the psychedelics is that it dissolves that. But the truth of the matter, like the actual fact, is that we're never separate from that anyway. And so any perception that we are separate from one another, God, ourselves, is just a trick of the mind and is an illusion in itself. We don't need the psychedelics to remember that or to realize that.
And it's interesting because so many people will, from a lot of plant medicines or psychedelic experiences, therapeutic or just recreationally, will come out of those experiences and say that they have an understanding for that concept of oneness. That was something that was shown to them, you know, whether it was in some sort of hallucination or voices speaking or whatever, you know, that mm-hmm. seems to be such a universal sort of articulated message from so many people.
Absolutely, because that is ultimate truth for humanity. And so when we have all of our ego, our issues, our conditioning, when we have all of that shit stripped away, that's what's revealed, is just the truth of the matter, which is oneness, a single reality that we are all connected and we are all love. Okay, my love, it's Amanda here. And instead of telling you about my yoga and Ayurveda offerings as per usual, if you want to learn about what I'm currently offering, go to yogaalchemy.com.au and you can see if there's one-on-ones available, group mentoring, teacher training, and all that stuff. What I'm really here to tell you about today is Karma Collab. So many of you are already familiar with this project that I started about 7 years ago in support of women and girls in rural India and also now here in Bali. Karma Collab is entering, as we go into this new year, its next evolution, its next phase. And part of that is a brand new jewelry collection where all of the proceeds go to providing education for girls and also providing support for mothers through pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. So it's something that I'm really excited about. And there's lots of other ways that we can join forces and really empower ourselves through the act of giving and receiving. So if you want to learn more about Karma Collab, join our mailing list, go to karmacollab.org. The link will be in the show notes, of course, and come and follow us on Instagram. So much love is poured into this project, and I'm really excited to have you as part of our global network of women who support other women through real action and activism. Mwah.
So I know that you have done some more interesting versions of psychedelics than me, and you know, I'm hoping that you're going to share some things, but I'm wondering, because you have experienced more, and I think I've asked this of you many years ago and I can't remember what you said, but I think you said that they were all good, but anyway, have you ever had any psychedelic experiences that weren't positive?
I'm going to be really honest and say no.
I didn't think so.
And you know, the reason I'm like, oh, I'm going to be honest is because maybe that sounds, I don't know, I just have this idea that maybe that sounds fucking annoying.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to be honest, and all I can really speak from is my own experience. And this is a total eye roll moment, and I'm aware of that, but I really do believe that because I only ever experimented with things like LSD and ayahuasca and DMT, whatever else, after I had an established yoga practice for many, many years, and that wasn't like the point of my yoga practice by any stretch, like that was already there, totally separate. But because I had that independent firsthand experience with these states of oneness and altered states of consciousness, and who knows, maybe I would, you know, if I did another ayahuasca journey, who knows, I might have a really challenging journey. You never know what you're going to get. And I'm not saying like, oh, like because I did yoga, you know, if you have a yoga practice, everything's going to be really joyful and just total bliss. No, it can be whatever medicine you need in that moment. And I guess to speak specifically about ayahuasca, maybe is, I think it's probably the most, the one that people are probably most curious about. I feel it's important to preface that if we have these kind of peak experiences through psychedelics or through any external means, without a practice or a framework to understand it or a practice to integrate it into our daily life, it's almost not worth having that peak experience. It almost becomes another trauma or another roadblock in our ability to connect to our source or our soul or oneness. Because what I've seen so, so, so often is that people start to use the psychedelic, let's just use ayahuasca as an example, people start to use ayahuasca as a crutch, and it can become very dysfunctional and addictive and unhealthy and so far from the original intention of using that plant medicine. And which is why it's always really important to be working with a experienced and authentic guide really, really important that we're discerning about that. And of course, just like in the yoga world, there's a lot of people calling themselves shamans that have done a 30-day online course. I don't know if that's exactly true, if there's online courses for shamanism, but you get what I'm saying. So it's really up to us as the quote user, it's not really a user, but you know, as the person on the receiving end of this medicine, to be discerning about who we're going on that journey with and making sure that there's someone really experienced and knowledgeable and in connection with the roots of that medicine.
And using, and I think also using your intuition. Like I, for a couple of years, looked for someone to guide me through an ayahuasca journey, and I met with a couple of people and it didn't feel right. I didn't trust them. I didn't want to be in that vulnerable state under their care. And so I opted out of that option. And that's why I haven't had an ayahuasca experience, because the opportunity presented itself quite a few times and it didn't feel right. I didn't intuitively feel like that person was going to guide me properly. So I think it is important to also use, yeah, like you said, I suppose you already said, use your discernment.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And that can be the make or break with having an experience that's really healing or having an experience that's just adding another trauma onto our list. Should I explain a little bit about a specific journey?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, I think the first time that I did a ayahuasca circle, I was fresh off a trip from India, as per usual, but I guess I feel like that's relevant because I had, in a way, without realizing, been prepping for going to those depths. And so, yeah, it was a circle with a group of friends, which I actually think is really amazing, because just like you were talking about with the MDMA experiences in your teens and 20s, that that experience of going on an ayahuasca journey with friends was also very, very bonding. And I guess we already had a certain level of deep bond in going there in the first place together, but I can't imagine doing, I think I've been quite lucky in that I've always been in circles with friends and quite tight knit. I think it would be quite different to, be in a room or in a bigger experience with people that you don't know. But anyway, basically we prepared. I think you do a special diet for the days before. And then you rock up around sunset. We went into like a beautiful kind of yurt out in nature, and the ceremonial vibe was set with specific songs and, you know, burning of probably sage or, you know, things like that. It's really calling in the protection and setting the scene. And this is like a common phrase when it comes to psychedelics, is to be really conscious of the set and setting. Have you heard that phrase? Set and setting?
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, so then we kind of entered into the journey of it, which is, to get specific, I think to make ayahuasca, you take two different plants and it's almost like a tea. Those two plants are mixed together and it creates the psychedelic effect, those two in combination. And so, yeah, we're invited like one by one to go up and take a cup and then go back to our spot and kind of drink it with intention and allow the medicine to do its work. And again, I don't want to sound so trite, but I had such a beautiful experience and I can remember it so, so vividly. You know, sometimes when you have a dream, like a really strong dream, and it, you can remember it so clearly, it feels almost more real than real life. Have you ever had that?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Like crickets. So it's like that. Like I can remember every scene of that journey just so, so clearly, vividly.
And what I was seeing. Can you tell us just like very briefly, like what were you seeing, you know, like what was it?
What I was seeing was a lot of like fractal kind of shapes and sacred geometry and like almost like with my mind or like with my spirit or whatever it is, like moving through like mazes and coming through this like other part, and then this opens up into a whole nother thing. And then it's kind of hard to explain, but I guess like what you would imagine, like when you see like psychedelic hippie, like LSD, it's that. Or if you think of something like an Alex Gray painting, that's like the most incredible representation of what I could never like bring into manifest form through a painting, but he, you know, obviously has that gift, and that's exactly how it felt and how it looked to me. And you know, looking around at my friends, I could see all the like webs of interconnectedness, and there were people in the circle having a really challenging time, you know, purging, which is really, really common, to vomit or to like need to go and basically have diarrhea. And that's really common. Yeah. So that was happening around, but I wasn't like, ooh, gross or anything like that. It's just, you know, you just have compassion in that moment for those people, and there's no judgment or anything like, ooh, you deserve that, or like you shouldn't eat so many Tim Tams or whatever. It's like you just see like the zoomed out bigger picture of it all, and you know it's all, you know, perfect and exactly what's meant to be happening, even though it might be challenging, it's for the greater good, you know. And there was times where I was just like sitting in meditation, but I was just like so comfortable in my body, like not one ache or niggle or pain, just like completely, completely comfortable, like beyond comfortable, just in bliss in my own body, which, you know, most people I'm sure can relate to sitting in meditation and not being like 100% comfortable. You might have like, oh, this thing in my knee or my back, or I might just, you know, not have the energy to sit up straight or whatever. It's like, no, all of that was just completely melted. And there was a point during the journey where I just wanted to go outside, and it was nighttime by this point, that you start around sunset. And so I went outside and I was just, you know, we were in nature, so it was beautiful, and looking out to all of the stars, and I was like doing cartwheels, and I could see all these like fractals zooming out of my feet and my hands and like into the cosmos, and it was just like this total bliss trip, like, you know, ecstasy, what can I say? But I feel like that could be very different if I did it again. It might not be like the same every time, and in subsequent journeys that I've had, it's been different from that even. Another journey that I did, I was, you know, sitting there and kind of waiting for the medicine to take effect. And I felt like I was just kind of in a black, not black in a scary or negative way at all, but just like a really dark, still, empty void. And I was just sitting in total silence, just kind of like waiting, but not really aware of waiting, not aware of time passing or anything like that. And then the next thing I knew, the person holding the circle was like, okay, like we're going to move into our closing now. And I was like, what? I was like, I missed the whole thing. Like, what the hell? Nothing happened. And I literally felt like 5 minutes had passed and it had been all night until morning. Wow. So I don't know. It can be really different each time. And so, yeah, I guess to like wind up the story of the journey, you know, I have going through all these different waves, going through different emotions, and just realizing realizing like the love and the connections and all of that between our friends and, you know, people that weren't there, and just really in gratitude and all of these type of positive, beautiful feelings that you know, I guess in a way we like seek to be in a lot of the time, or, you know, we put things in our psyche that make us forget that we are that. We are those infinite qualities of gratitude and compassion and unconditional love. Eventually they bring it to a close and say, like, does anyone want one last round? And, you know, if people do, then they do. And eventually we, you know, get kind of out of that zone and like formally close the circle. And then I think in the morning, so by this time it's like sunrise, and then we usually would have some like soup or some fruit or something gentle to break the fast and just start like integrating. And I think shortly after that, then people usually share about their experience, which is quite an important part of the processing, because if it has been really emotional or very, you know, a deep healing, then it can be, yeah, it is very important to speak it out and to process it in that way and be held by your community and the people that are holding the circle. Mm. What were you going to say before I interrupted you?
I was just going to say, no, I interrupted you. I was just going to say that it's interesting listening to your experience, and I think that your experience was in a formal context more than my experience with mushrooms, which was done a little bit more, even though it was done with a bit of an intention of this can be an experiment with a psychedelic that can be beneficial, but there wasn't the formal.
You didn't go on like a mushroom journey.
No. But a lot of my friends that might have done mushrooms with me would say that they had the similar feelings, like the feelings of gratitude and happiness and, you know, love after, for days after. Like they feel mm-hmm. that. Whereas mm-hmm. I would say that my, and this is where I think it is important to say that there is exceptions to the rule that this is just a universally positive experience for everybody, because it
is. Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, you already said that, but there are exceptions to that it's beneficial to everybody, because even, you know, for me, I would say I feel after mushrooms, I feel down the next day. I feel depressed. I feel a slighter disposition towards the negative, a negativity bias. I feel literally, if mm-hmm. I think about it now, I literally feel depleted of my feel-good neurotransmitters, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting, because I recently...
Well, I know a lot of people that feel that way about cannabis as well.
Yeah. So it is important to say it's not a... And you, I guess you've already said it, but in a different way, that it's not
a cure-all. And it's not...
Exactly.
Yeah, I would never advise anyone to do psychedelics, because actually at the end of the day, even though I've, you know, kind of shared my positive experience, it's so not necessary.
No.
And I really do think, like I said before, if you're having this peak experience without any tools to integrate it into your daily life and to have that touch point to those realms without the artificial or the external substance, then it's not worth it.
No.
It just becomes another trauma, another block. And it's interesting, because I think before this renaissance of psychedelics, or even, you know, in the 60s when psychedelics were originally used in alternative culture or like maybe spiritual or conscious circles, religion was really the one and only path to spirituality, I guess. And that's kind of an interesting breakdown of the religious paradigm, because religion is really one person regurgitating from a book someone else's experiences and teaching from that without actually having themselves the direct experience of God or of oneness that, you know, Jesus was speaking of. Like when you have a psychedelic experience, or if you have, you know, a yogic experience, I'd say, and you read the Bible or you read the words of Jesus, it comes with a completely different understanding, because you can read between the lines of what he was saying, and what he was explaining and expressing was his direct experience with universal consciousness. But then, of course, it got twisted, and it's like, you know, what's that game? Like, I don't know, like when one person whispers to another and the message gets like mixed up.
Chinese whispers.
It's like that, you know, and these priests being like the gate holders to experience or connection with God or with oneness. I'll just use the word God because it's, you know, simple, but you don't have to believe in God to have that experience. When psychedelics came into the fore, it kind of broke down that whole paradigm, and people were able to take for the first time into their own hands their connection with Source. So I think that's really cool. But at the end of the day, you know, just like religion, we're placing all of our ability to connect to that realm and believe that it's outside of us or separate from us and it's dependent on this psychedelic, but then we're missing the point. The point is that it's always there.
Available to us.
And even people like Ramdas, who's, you know, it's always available to us in any moment without any substance. And that's the beauty of a yoga practice. It gives people in a very practical, simple, kind of even like rudimentary, kind of boring way, a very profound way to have a direct experience with their universal consciousness.
And it's interesting that you are referring
again, to... I come back to the same thing I talk about every single week, is everyone should do yoga.
It's always yoga. And it's interesting that you're referring to religion, because there, well, we'll link a couple of podcasts if you want to listen to them, but we'll talk about them later. But there's lots of people that have gone through the Bible and other ancient texts, and basically, particularly with parts of the Bible, they're basically, well, they're alleging that they're actually references to psychedelic experiences. Like the burning bush is a particular potential psychedelic, and there's all this other symbology that all of it relates back to different plant medicines and psychedelics that obviously were teaching people about God, in inverted commas, about that unification, and perhaps a lot of those original teachings, in inverted commas, were channeled through experiences of psychedelics, you know,
and then
misinterpreted and then used, unfortunately, in
or not less... even misinterpreted, but deliberately suppressed.
Yes,
because if anyone and everyone can have a direct experience of God, then what is the role of the priest? And what is the function of the church? Nothing.
Yes.
And let's just remember, Jesus wasn't a Christian.
No.
The Catholic Church, the Christian religion, came long, long after Jesus was gone. You know, he was just a dude having his direct experience. So, yeah, it's really interesting when you start to learn about the ways that different psychedelics were used across cultures, from Native American culture, South America, I mean, all over the world.
Every single culture has a psychedelic, or particularly a plant medicine,
yes,
that they have used as a tool, a spiritual awakening tool. Nearly every single Indigenous culture has one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've obviously sort of evolved alongside these plants.
Along plants.
Yeah.
And you can even, you know, think about, like, are the plant, like, there's kind of this, when you really come into a deep connection and relationship with plants, it's like, are they here for us or are we here for them? Like, animals, I can't remember if it's monkeys or elephants or who, but some animals particularly like follow the migration pattern of cows and buffaloes and seek the mushrooms that grow in their poop and then eat them to have the psychedelic effect. Like, where is that? Maybe in Fantastic Fungi or something.
Yeah, must be in Fantastic Fungi. And I love all the symbology stuff. There's so much of it, and I wish I could remember some, but the only one that I can remember is the, you know, the little red mushroom. I can't remember what it's called, but it's the mushroom that's actually depicted in all of the original, like, fairy tales and everything, the red mushroom with the white dots. So that's a psychedelic mushroom that grows, I don't think it grows here, it grows in Europe, and it's depicted in so many children's stories and fairy tales, and all the elves and gnomes are always sitting on those things, you know, like, it's from our childhood. But perhaps a lot of those, there's speculation that a lot of the authors and illustrators, you know, were inspired by psychedelics, and that allowed that creativity of those stories to flow through. And the the red and white is also associated with all of the Christmas stuff. So there's a really interesting podcast that goes through that, and we'll goes through that in detail, I should say, and we'll link it in the show notes. But talks through, you know, that they used to go down chimneys to get the bags of the mushrooms, and that's where the Santa sort of symbology came from, with him coming down the chimney and the red and white and all of it. So it's very and the reindeer, apparently they played a role in it. So yeah, it's incredible.
There's like hints of it all through culture.
It's yes, really
kind of like a cosmic joke.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are starting to run into the hour, if you can believe it. So I'm wondering if you have anything else that you need to add before we roll into recommendations.
Well, I think I've already made my point clear that before anyone entertains the idea of doing a psychedelic journey of any kind, is first of all to have a yoga practice under your belt, but also, like, it can be so much more subtle than what we kind of, like, silly Western people think. Like, we don't actually need to gorge on these plant medicines or even, you know, drugs like LSD. We don't need to take them in big doses, which is, I guess, is like the whole point of microdosing. But you know, even like people like the shamans, I mean, not that I know a lot of shamans, but few people that I have spoken to, it's like you get to a point, and I can feel this for myself with like San Pedro in particular, which is a cactus. Once you've had that deep experience with the plant, it's almost like you come into relationship with it. And so it's not like you need to, and I think this definitely, again, is dependent on having an integration practice and a tool and some tools to, you know, make sense of what you're experiencing and to continue it on, so that we're not just like perpetually seeking connection and forgetting that we're always connected. It can be much more subtle, you know, just having the plants like in your home or like in your vicinity, knowing where they grow in nature or something like that, and being in relationship with just the actual living, breathing plant is enough to like trigger the cellular memories within your psyche and remind you of those expanded states. So yeah, it's just, I guess, something interesting to consider, that we don't, like someone said to me once, ayahuasca is actually really, really old medicine. And we actually don't need it in this time. Like we are moving into a paradigm beyond needing to even drink this medicine. We can be in communication and relationship with these plants in a much more subtle way if we allow ourselves to be. So that's, I guess, it resonates for me. And I guess, yeah, something just to consider.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
Yeah. No.
Do you still want to do ayahuasca?
Well, that's the thing. No, I think, like you've already said,
I want to rephrase how I said that because that's not correct and it's not the way I feel about it. I said, do you want to do ayahuasca? I was like, no, it's not like that. It's like, but you know exactly what I mean. Do you want to have that experience? No, I do.
Well, the thing is, and this is maybe a nice little sort of rounding out of the conversation, and this conversation reminds me of another conversation on another podcast where we talked, and I'm sure we've actually talked about it on numerous occasions, about like the self-development stuff. And I remember when I did the D-Martini experience and I thought that that was going to like fix me. And at the end of that experience, I went, oh my God, I just spent $6,000 and I'm not fixed. And fool me once, fool me twice. I realized in that moment that nothing was going to fix me except for me.
Well, that is the most profound realization. And it's nothing like against D-Martini because it could be about anything. It could be about like, holotropic breath work. It can be about ayahuasca. It can be about yoga. It can be about fasting, whatever.
There were so many things that I'd done and spent so much money on before that moment that I actually realized that nothing was the answer. And I think that I have the maturity and experience and capacity now to go, yes, part of me is like, oh, maybe it would be interesting to do it. But part of me is like, exactly like you just said, it's not going to fix me. There's nothing in that experience that I can't work on.
Because you are not a problem to be solved. Our community, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are doing this work to dismantle this idea that it's quite a lot of work because it's really requiring a big mental shift of getting out of this problem solution mindset.
Yeah.
And understanding that there is no answer because there is actually nothing wrong with you.
No, exactly. And so I think my short answer to, well, that was my long answer. So my short answer is no, I don't think so.
Hello, it's Sarah here. And I'm just briefly interrupting this episode to tell you a little bit more about what I offer. So I've worked with literally hundreds and hundreds of women, helping them transform their health, hormones, fertility, and more. And I absolutely love working one-on-one with women because we're all uniquely different. So if you're interested in learning more about coaching with me, or if you're ready to book an initial consultation, you'll find the link in the show notes. I look forward to hearing from you.
Wow. Cool.
So, well, recommendations, would you like to, you've sort of already
Said it, but yeah, the documentary Fantastic Fungi, it's so beautiful.
So good.
I don't think I could have ever expected to feel inspired by a movie about mushrooms.
Oh, but it's so good.
I did. It's so uplifting, beautiful. And that's like, I guess, kind of an example of what I was saying. Like even just watching this documentary gets you into the frequency of mushrooms.
Definitely.
It doesn't have to involve like eating a kilo of mushroom, of, you know, medicinal magic mushrooms. You can literally get into that vibe by watching this film.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. I loved it.
And we actually bought it off their website like just, you know, to support the people that have made it because it was so beautiful. So I would recommend people do that.
It is on Netflix, though. If anyone is on Netflix, it's on there in the documentary
section. Watch it first on Netflix and then go and buy it from the people.
Yeah, great.
Because you'll love it and you'll want to watch it again.
I do have a recommendation. It's a Joe Rogan pod episode. It's
controversial person to be recommended.
Oh my gosh! How dare I recommend someone like him? I love him. I love him. It is episode 1543 with Brian Merarescu. I'm probably butchering that. And Graham Hancock.
Cool.
And it's talking all about plant medicine and psychedelics and some of the symbology. And yes, it is an amazing one. There are actually so many on the Joe Rogan podcast because he has an interest in that. So, and also just side recommendation, Michael Pollan has some great interviews. He's got a book about it and his experiences.
Oh, I just thought of another one. Can I say another one?
Yes, of course. Go.
Well, I've noticed as well, like especially in Bali and in different kind of entrepreneurial circles that I know of and, you know, I'm not really in but are on the periphery of. I know a lot of people in like the startup entrepreneurial corporate scene are using psychedelics as a, I guess, a team building. It's probably the wrong way to phrase it, but like in a team environment for their company, basically. And there's a lot of people talking about the relationship between psychedelics and success. And that's what was, I think, maybe even the title of an Aubrey Marcus podcast that was, that we'll link in the show notes.
Beautiful. And I think that is a wrap.
Thank you so much, as always, for listening to the Elevate podcast. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review so we can keep bringing these conversations to you all.